Early yesterday morning, he was supposed to take a flight out of Edmonton at 8 o'clock, so he left home around 6 o'clock, and then he found out that the flight has been cancelled. So you see, unfortunately, because of this Christmas rush and the flight schedules and so on, he had to go back and then take a flight late in the evening to arrive in Toronto well past midnight. So he went to reach his hotel around 1:32 this morning. So you can see the kind of sacrifices he has made to be with us tonight. And I think we need to thank him as well as his family for being so considerate and so generous with their time and with their effort. So could you please welcome Dennis Edmonds.
Saying I wish to thank the organizers of this event for inviting me to come here this evening and talk. It's my intention to share my experience with you this evening of my representing Omar Carroll. That's the Scottish version of Carroll. But Omar has spent a third of his life languishing in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, while awaiting trial by a military tribunal. You're all aware of that. I'm also aware that you've been listening to the CBC documentary and various talks, and I will try to be as brief as possible. But truly, it's very difficult to give you a sense, a taste, a smell of Omar Carroll and the conditions that he's been surviving under within a very short period of time. So if you'll bear with me, I anticipate my talk will last about 35 minutes. Omar Carroll was 15 years of age when he was detained by the Americans, taken to Bagram in Afghanistan, and then later transported to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He is now 22 years of age. I could simply sum up Omar Carroll's situation for you in this sentence. And then you can all go home. It is simply this. I have never met someone who has been so abandoned and so abused by those who should know better. Now I intend to talk about how I came involved with Omar Carroll and take you through the legal journey we have embarked upon Omar Carroll, and then take you into Omar Carroll's story himself. And in doing so, I am not looking for any applauses. What I want to show you is how it is possible to take on big government and be successful. Not quickly, not in a short period of time, but by challenging intelligently, each and every one of you can have confidence that you're not powerless. I was at the end of a four-year criminal trial when I had the opportunity of handling the Omar Carroll file. And after speaking with my wife, Patricia, and my co-counsel, Nate Whitman, I decided to take on this farm. And with only a gut instinct of what lay ahead, and I think my gut instinct was horribly inaccurate, Nate and I set out upon representing Omar. And that was 6 years ago. And Omar comes to what's called as a trial in Guantanamo Bay, commencing January 26th of next year. Now, with the time constraints provided, I hope to share with you the highlights of Omar's journey as well as our legal strategies and our legal battles. And in doing so, I hope to bring you both the good, the bad, and the ugly. And hopefully, at the end of my talk, I will have compelled at least certain of you to take action on behalf of Omar. Now let me tell you that you should be aware that when you take on a case as meritorious as this, there may be no funding whatsoever for it. And I mean by funding, I don't mean monies to pay for my legal hours and time. I mean monies to pay for transportation, no money, money to pay for photocopying or legal disbursements. And that reality came readily upon to us early in our journey on behalf of Omar Khadr. We naively requested financial assistance from the Canadian government, and I did so at a time when I was appointed by the Pentagon to be a foreign attorney consultant for Omar. And that's a nice fancy title. I haven't got a clue what it means. I think what it means, as long as I'm nice and I smile, I get into Guantanamo Bay. But when I start challenging and asking questions, which I've done, I'm then banned from Guantanamo Bay, which has happened. Or, alternatively, I'm flown to a private airfield in Florida, where I'm searched and questioned for a day by guys wearing black glasses, without any help at all from my government. So I'd asked the Canadian government for financial assistance, and they were pretty quick to respond, unusual for a government, and said no. And so then I attempted to contact Legal Aid Ontario, recognizing that Omar was domiciled here, and asked for funding. And quite politely and quite properly, they told us that they had no mandate to provide funding outside the jurisdiction of Ontario and particularly Canada. And after years of no contact whatsoever from the Canadian Bar Association, which is a major organization to which I put money to, the Canadian Bar finally came out and asked the Prime Minister of Canada to negotiate with the US government for the immediate release of Omar back to Canada. And so, in fact, I was present when the Canadian Bar came out with that announcement, because I was at the Canadian Bar Association in Calgary and encouraged them to do so. And so, recognizing that it was a good time to move in here and ask for some funding, and also recognizing the mandate of the Canadian Bar was to improve the law, improve access to justice, I felt this was appropriate to ask for funding. And I was told quite simply, there was no funding available. And having been a keynote speaker for the Canadian Bar at different times in my life, I realize how I'm well aware of how well I get treated, like any other person with a keynote speaker, with fancy hotels and unlimited expenses. But yet, here was a national legal body that had no money to assist whatsoever. And that situation has continued to the present day. So tonight I encourage you to stick your hands in your pocket and provide some funding. But as disappointing as these refusals were, that didn't deter myself or my co-counsel, Nate Whitley, from our objective. And I simply relied upon my own savings and funding from other trials I was involved in, unlike my co-counsel mate with the assistance of his law firm. And so let me say to you that that doesn't make me stand out as somebody meritorious. Because I say to you, there were times, and there are times, when I wondered how much longer I could fund Omar's defense at the expense of my family. Because as my commitment to Omar's defense increased, my ability to take on other legal work diminished. However, at all times, my wife Patricia, as well as my children Duncan and Cameron, felt and have felt this was simply the right thing to do. And my boy Cameron. I'm not like the Irish who love applauses. We Scots are a more modest type. And my boy Cameron understood that I couldn't attend his high school graduation because I had a commitment to assist Omar in Guantanamo Bay. And let me tell you, there have been times when I have rehearsed a speech to tell Omar why I can no longer represent him. And each and every time I consider that, I remind myself of my first time meeting Omar and what he said to me when I left him. He said, "You will leave me, everyone does." And so I'm sad to share this with you, that there are times I find myself walking the floor. There are times I get up during the night when I've been away from Omar for a period of time, wondering what more I can do. How can I bring him home? And so I've now become not only a full-time lawyer, but I've also become a full-time speaker. Because I realize that a political solution is the only way to save Omar. And that is the only reason I'm here tonight. I have spoken to universities, from Yale University to University of San Francisco, from Halifax to Vancouver to and back again. I have spoken to legal associations. I have spoken numerous occasions, and I have friends here, we're going to depose to that, to Muslim groups. And I've spoken to a few Christian groups. And I've gone, as I said, from one end of Canada to the other and circled the border. Because I will not rest until I have assured myself that I have done everything possible to assist Omar Khadr. Because when Omar Khadr is found guilty, as he assuredly will do, in that sham process called the Military Commission trial, I will have to be able to say, I tried, and I tried my best. Now let me just say to you, that each and every talk I have been given, whether it's south of the border or north of the border, has been well received. In fact, I recently gave a talk to the Law Societies of Canada, who gave me an award, a nice lovely little glass honour, because they wish to honour me for my pro bono work on behalf of Omar Khadr. But I told them there's not such a word in the Scottish language as pro bono. And I never became a lawyer to work for nothing. And I received a standing ovation from over 200 lawyers for my work. Wasn't I really an important person? Well, let me tell you, I received not a single email or a single call from one of those individuals the following day. And as I journeyed from one end of Canada to the other and south of the border talking, becoming a professional speaker, looking for a political resolution, bringing Omar Khadr's plight and the plight of those detainees in Guantanamo Bay, and explaining it in terms of a breach of the rule of law, a stain on justice. People go home every night when they listen to me, and they must feel good about themselves. I hope they do, because I rarely hear from them afterwards. And so I say to you, the fact that my family and my legal practice has suffered in the process has never deterred myself or my co-counsel from representing Omar, because we believe that Omar Khadr is a just cause. Now you may ask yourself, you or anybody else here, why? Why should anyone shoulder the burden of helping Omar Khadr, a perfect stranger? And that is, there's no real easy answer to that. All I can say to you is, I follow a line of many other people, including yourselves, who participate in the communities. if we don't stand up for those who are in most need of help, who need the world to know they're being abused and tortured, especially a child, then who else will stand up? So if not us, who else? And I think that sums it up. And at the end of the day, in my view, when I follow the teachings of my father, who was just an ordinary truck driver back in Scotland, it's not about what we have, but it's what we do that leaves an imprint on our lives and on our communities. And so I say to each and every one of you here, particularly the youth, there are great challenges out there waiting to be undertaken in the name of justice, and you can be successful in doing so. You're only limited by your own imagination. If I and Nate Whitman, the little guys from Edmonton, can take on governments and challenge governments, then surely you and your organisations can also do that, and do that more successfully. So this now takes me then to the legal steps that we have taken on behalf of Omar Khan. The complexity of Omar's case, with its expansive issues, has taken us to courts from Washington DC, to Ottawa, from Edmonton, to Winnipeg, to Toronto, and back and forth. And these are just a few courts that we have been in. And in doing so, let me tell you that we have used the law to promote justice and individual liberty as restraint upon the exercise of power by governments. Law is a powerful tool. Use it. We have the distinction of appearing in both the Canadian Supreme Court and the US Supreme Court, in the Federal Court of Appeal in Canada and the Federal Court of Appeal in the United States, all for the same client, Omar Khan. So let me tell you some of the more significant challenges that we took on behalf of Omar Khan. In 2002, I applied and was granted standing to file a brief before the US Supreme Court in the first challenge on behalf of the detainees called Rousseau versus Bush. And I limited my submissions to two general subjects relating to Omar Khan's status as a child and as a Canadian. We emphasized Omar's status both under the Geneva Conventions and under the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. And we said, and we argued before the Supreme Court, that it ought to interpret its constitution in a manner consistent with those fundamental principles of law, the Geneva Conventions and the International Convention on the Rights of the Child. The International Convention on the Rights of the Child is the most, is a treaty, it's the most, what is the word? Almost every country in the world has signed on to that basic treaty. Only two countries have not. One is Somalia, and the other is the United States. And what is our treaty about? It's about affording protection for the most vulnerable in our societies, children. And so, we initially requested the federal government of Canada to file a similar brief. I suggested that it should do so because it was acting on behalf of a Canadian youth, and it provides some support when we argue before the Supreme Court. But the Canadian government said no. And this was a significant reminder of the lack of assistance we could expect from our government at the time. Because that same government, it was a Liberal government at the time, in 1997, 4 years earlier, had filed a similar brief before the United States Supreme Court on its own volition on behalf of Stan Fodor from Jasper, Alberta, who was convicted of the killing of a 75-year-old Texas woman and was facing the death penalty. And the Canadian government in 1997 argued that Mr. Fogo had been denied consular access, a violation of international law. And yet in 2002, when we asked the Canadian government to assist Omar Khadr, a 15-year-old youth, languishing in Guantanamo Bay, our government was not willing to assert that both US and international law requires governments such as ours in the United States to provide children such as Omar with special safeguards and care appropriate to their age. We later followed it up by being successful before the Federal Court of Canada in obtaining an interim injunction preventing CSIS and the Department of Foreign Affairs representatives from going down to Guantanamo Bay, interrogating Omar Khadr in Guantanamo Bay, sharing the fruits of those interrogations with the Americans.
Shame.
At a time when Omar had been unlawfully detained without charges. He was never charged for the first 3 years he was there. He had no access to counsel, had been kept in solitary confinement for 18 months, with his visitors only being his jailers and his abusers. And all the while, Canada was aware that Omar had been subject to one of the many techniques to use in Guantanamo for extracting information, and one of those was the frequent flyer program. Language like the frequent flyer program is one of many types of sentences used by the Americans to describe torture. And at that time, Canada knew that 3 weeks prior to their arrival, Omar was in an intense sleep deprivation program, where every 3 hours from hour, he was moved from cell to cell to cell to cell, day after day, week after week, being ready for interrogations by Canadian officials. And you saw Mr. Cassetti, I presume, tonight talking about that. What was interesting about Mr. Cassetti in my interview is that he found it quite interesting how well it works. Because he talked about how these detainees would be walking around their cells, just hallucinating, talking to fictional people, going insane. And it was in those conditions that detainees like Omar were taken into interrogation rooms and questioned, and the answers they give have been relied upon against Omar Khadr in the forthcoming military commission trial in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And yet our government says nothing, has said nothing, and continues to say nothing.
Shame.
And not only just about Omar Khadr, but about that stain called Guantanamo Bay. In a major rebuke to the Canadian government, as in response to an application we brought before the Canadian Supreme Court, the court ruled that Omar Khadr's treatment at the hands of the US in Guantanamo Bay, this is in May of this year, was a breach of the International Convention on Torture and the Geneva Conventions, and that Canada was complicit in that conduct. And in support of that application, I had interviewed ex-detainees at Guantanamo Bay, interviewed Omar in Guantanamo Bay, got to see some other individuals and another to talk about, and then prepared these what I would call torture affidavits. And I used to think of myself as a tough criminal lawyer, but I would say to you, my journey in the last 6 years, particularly my visits to Guantanamo Bay, meeting the people there, seeing these detainees, I found myself in Florida feeling quite weepy, ready to break into tears, because I couldn't comprehend the overwhelming abuse of human dignity. And when I saw Omar and I looked at his body and I looked at the records that I privy to and other records, and yet, you know, I tried to, all I was able to do was bring a very discreet portion of evidence before the Canadian Supreme Court, because I had all these other documents that would have given a far broader context of what takes place in that damning place called Guantanamo Bay to human beings. Yet the military judge refused to allow me to give them to our Supreme Court. In fact, I even offered to have those documents put into a secret envelope only for the judge's eyes only, and still was told. And if you think about it, what greater repute can you have as a civil government that our government is accused of being complicit in the torture and abuse of a Canadian citizen, and a youth at that? In doing so, our government traded upon each and every one of you's reputation and the reputations of your fathers and your grandfathers. And where was the outrage? I can tell you, I didn't hear. And I've been a bit harsh, because when I thought about it afterwards, I realized that something did happen. I realized that Canadians from one end of Canada to the other were aware of Omar Khadr and were at least debating the rights and wrongs of his detention. And I should tell you that it took 3 years of battles with the federal government just on that particular aspect leading to the Supreme Court. And we spent multi-thousands of dollars in the process. And we were challenged every step of the way. We had numerous discoveries, numerous affidavits to respond to. In fact, I recall one day feeling pretty exhausted and tired and sitting in this room at a teleconference where we were doing these cross-examinations. And there were five government lawyers at one side of the table. And for a moment I felt I was representing some serial killer, as opposed to requesting that the documents that Canada held that had given, and had given to the United States to assist them against Omar, and that's what we were asking for. Fair process, what you give to the Americans, give to us. It took 3 years of constant fighting. And even when we went before the Supreme Court, and I've been before the Supreme Court before, it's a very simple matter in the sense that you file your brief, Crown files their brief, you meet in Ottawa, and you argue. But we were challenged several times to have our briefs expunged, because our government did not wish to have any reference whatsoever to conditions in Guantanamo Bay. They said it had nothing to do with Omar Khadr, and we argued it had everything to do with Omar. And if we are not busy enough, we have been traveling to Guantanamo Bay on a regular basis over the years to represent Omar's interests before this, I hate to call it trial, before this military commission process. They've now built a super courtroom in Guantanamo Bay. And so when you're looking and you see pictures, and CBC does pictures of Guantanamo Bay, they're not allowed to do anything. That documentary, the CBC team was stuck in a hangar. They couldn't even take pictures of signs saying, you be careful as you drive, you can't run over a gun and one. Everything's top secret. And you should be aware that I anticipate being in Guantanamo Bay for most of January. And when we go there, we are charged by the Americans We're charged for accommodation, we're charged for a stay, we're charged for food. And so I always see that as a tactic to make it more difficult to be there. Because it's not easy being in Guantanamo Bay. I never ever meet Omar Khadr unless I'm dressed with a good suit on, a good tie and a good shirt. Because I always give him, want to make it fairly clear, he's my client, he's worthy of respect. And I really get to see him without trouble. One of the best things they like to do to me is help me stand out in the 40 degree sunshine, like this. And usually I stand next close to a building that has air conditioning that I was once allowed to be there and stay there, and it was time for me to visit Omar. But, you know, like my family history, we're always in trouble, and so I'm not the nice guy, a nice Canadian Scot, a nice Scottish Canadian that first arrived on the shores. So I stand out there for hours, roasting. And when I go to see Omar, I'm usually just drenched. I look as if I've just come out of a shower. And it's gotten to be such a habit that Omar looks forward to it, because he giggles when he sees me walking the ceiling. So what exactly is the case, or the Pentagon's case against Omar Khadr? Well, he's charged with a variety of charges, including spying on a battlefield, conspiracy, an attempted murder, and with murder. It all really comes down to two things. He's accused of throwing a hand grenade that killed Corporal Chris Spears. Now, the Bush administration designated detainees captured in the battlefield of Afghanistan as enemy combatants. You must have heard that phraseology. It has no standing in international law. It's a creation of those crazy people who were in the Bush administration. Because its position is simply this, that US forces had UN authority to attack Afghanistan. But anybody who shot back and fired back at this invasion force committed an illegal act and therefore was determined as a terrorist and therefore an enemy combatant. And by that designation, it meant that they could have called them Martians. It just simply meant that they have no rights, no rights whatsoever. And whatever rights they're going to give, they will make them up as it goes along. And experts say that even if Khadr had thrown a hand grenade, and even the fact that he was a child soldier who was tortured into confessing was somehow overlooked, the act of resisting an attack by an occupying force alone might not be a cause for prosecution. Because it's been pointed out on numerous occasions in numerous books, a fighter killing another fighter during warfare is not an act of a terrorist. It may be brutal, and it may be tragic, but it is the act of a soldier. And that soldier, if captured, is not a criminal. He is a prisoner of war. Moreover, if like Omar, he is a child, the Geneva Conventions require that he not be treated as a prisoner of war, but as a victim of war. And these are all international treaties, except the Americans refused to accede to the fact, international law applies within Guantanamo Bay. Humanitarian law doesn't apply in Guantanamo Bay. And our government has never stood up and said a single word. And by doing so, it preys upon you and my reputation in the international community. And how much lower can it get when it's not as if they're not standing up to represent some killer, but it's a boy. It's a boy who should be has all types of protection in a place that has been internationally condemned. So, I'm going to move on and take you to the Omar Khadr story. But let me first describe the context in which he was arrested, detained, abused, and tortured. Omar was 15 years of age, in the company of hardened militants who were alleged to be associates of his father, who is now since deceased. As a result, there was a massive bombing of the compound he was in. Everybody was killed except Omar. And the eyewitness soldier, OC1 as he's designated, saw reports that Omar's back was to the fighting. He was against a wall, far away from wherever the fighting was taking place, and the soldier simply shot him twice in the back. That's his statement. And in addition to being shot in the back twice, because Omar has two big holes in his body, he had been wounded in his head, blind in one eye, a damaged second eye, and his leg is full, and body is full of shrapnel. In fact, some of the shrapnel wounds still come to the surface and he picks them up. And then he was eventually loaded onto a military helicopter, and he regained consciousness several days later in a hospital in a US internment facility in Bagram, Afghanistan. And little did Omar know that his ordeal had only just begun. Welcome to American justice. At the Bagram hospital, Omar's interrogators, and you probably have seen that on CBC, they couldn't wait for him to become conscious so they can get him into the interrogation room and work on him. And I'm sure that program talked about stress positions. It's a nice word, stress positions. Think about how damaged and crippled that body was. And then you've got these goons like Cassetti and Claus, who are part of the interrogation team, who are manipulating the body to be put into positions at incredible pain, all without medication. Mr. Cassetti may have a bit of conscience these days. But I remember talking to Omar about him. I showed him. He talked about certain things. And all he said was, he got very silent and he said, Cassetti was bad. And if Cassetti was bad, then Claus was better. Claus was worse. I remember Omar was humiliated. He tells you. And Cassetti supports that. These detainees were put into crucifixion poses in dojos, with their bodies raised into positions of extensions that caused agonizing pain, and left there to pee on themselves. And after that, they were laughed at. A little boy like Omar, 15. Omar was 15 when he was hung up in these doorways. Omar was 15 when he would laugh at him because he urinated at himself because he wouldn't want to go to the toilet. Not only did they laugh at him, they said things to him that made him feel like it was his fault. And because it's his fault, he'd better clean up that urine or pee that's on the floor. Because you've got to keep the floor tidy, so we'll use your body and your hands, the mop. You know, and Omar was also singled out for night duty. And night duty was carrying buckets of water up and down this hallway, heavy buckets of water. In fact, one of the doctors I have talks about how his wounds would seep with blood in doing that. And what Cassetti didn't tell you was, with due respect to the ladies here, was he had a particular little trick. Because he's a fun guy, Cassetti. Cassetti liked to go up to Omar's bed, drop his pants, stick his bum in his face, and flatulate. And you know what? The nurses and the doctors there thought that was funny. And Omar was 15. And during the 3 months in Bagram Hospital Prison, Omar was interrogated repeatedly by a military interrogation team under the control of Sergeant Claus. In fact, I count, Claus interviewed him 49 times. And Claus was later charged and convicted of the death of one Muslim detainee and the severe injury of two other detainees when he crippled, using the same interrogation teams and techniques at the same time that he'd been used against Omar. And of course, when he was found guilty in mitigation before the court, what did he say? He said he felt pressure to get results. And for that, he received a 6-month sentence. And I still lack the ability to discover where he'd served any time whatsoever. Think about the value that we place on Muslim lives. When in the position of authority, you cripple two detainees, you kill another one, and you get 6 months.
You get less than Israel.
I say to you, it goes against the very core of humanity that the torture and abuse of a 15-year-old Omar and other detainees would take place in a hospital, which I view as a sacred place, when particularly when people are at their most vulnerable. And Omar describes the most predominant sound coming out of that hospital was the cries of pain and the cries of torture. That hospital was no more than a systemic torture chamber. And when I told you I felt weepy and ready to cry, I can tell you it took me months after looking at my affidavits from different detainees when I really understood that I'd seen these movies, Dr. Jekyll type of movies. And I realized that Dr. Jekyll movies were nothing compared to what that hospital was. It was just a systemic, disgusting torture chamber. And yet no voices were raised against such abuses. Clearly, any military personnel of all stripes present and working in that hospital were doctors, lawyers, nurses, soldiers. They were all complicit in that torture and abuse by the very old silence. And so was our government. Because our government was aware of them, what was going on in Baghdad. In fact, our government tried to get Omar Khadr out of Baghdad and then backed off. And it was during that time that the Americans were able to show that they had a bad guy. Because in Bagram they made Omar confess to anything, as they did to each and every other detainee, and showed to the Canadian authorities, look! So Canada backs off. And one particular incident stands out for me when I was questioning Omar. It was just sort of a throwaway question. I asked him about being ready to go to Guantanamo. And he said, Dennis, you know, they did feed us for 3 days prior to leaving on the plane to Guantanamo. And they only gave us sips of water a day and a half prior to it. And I thought about that, and I said, ask questions about that. And the reason being, of course, is that the security risk to have them use the toilet. So we starve them, we dehydrate them, we throw them on the plane. Imagine if you treated a dog like that, or your pet like that. It wouldn't be long before someone would come knocking on your door to complain, or the police would come to your door, or somebody from the SPCA. That is a particular example, I suggest to you, of how Muslim detainees were viewed. No better than animals. And I say Muslim detainees because no American goes to Guantanamo Bay. Any American picked up, whether in the battlefield of Afghanistan or or for tourism, doesn't go to Guantanamo Bay. He goes home to America with the full due process of law. Guantanamo Bay is not for white Anglo-Saxon boys. In July of 2004, when Omar was 17, he was moved to Camp 5. And in his new cell, the fluorescent ceiling lights stayed on 24 hours a day. And sometimes he went for weeks without seeing daylight. His cell was kept cold, and Omar spent a lot of time trying to keep warm. He would blow himself up. He tried to cover himself with a blanket, assuming there was a blanket there, and it wasn't confiscated. And after a day in the Camp 5 cell, Omar had nothing more to see, to touch, to taste, to hear, to smell. He was accompanied only by his own disordered thoughts. And he would try to sleep the time away, but he couldn't because of the cold. And over the course of any given month, Omar didn't know whether he would get to see the sun, have a conversation with another human being, or be allowed to wear clothes. I talked to you about the frequent flyer program. Well, keeping people cold and freezing was another particular model used in Guantanamo Bay. Constantly frozen, constantly shivering. And it was in those conditions I first met Omar. Not in Camp 5, but in Camp 6. You're shown the sanitized version of Guantanamo Bay. You're shown the cages. As bad as those are, and I can tell you, I have two Labradors. They're treated much better than those human beings in Guantanamo Bay. There used to be only one secret prison. There are now two. And the only one that was there that I knew of, anyway, until very recently, was Camp 6. And Camp 6 is it's not a cage. It's a huge concrete building somewhere in the desert, no windows, but air-conditioned ventilators on top, wire all around, some of the toughest soldiers you'll ever come across, and it's silent. Deathly silent. And it's designed for deep sensory deprivation. And I can tell you, I know it works. In fact, if you speak to Michelle Shepherd, a trauma star, she will tell you that in her limited journeys in Guantanamo, not to the places I go to, it takes her days to get over being there. Well, I can tell you, it works for me when I go there. And it was in that particular cell I'll always recall meeting Omar Khadr. And I found myself shocked. I found myself shocked less as a lawyer and more as a father. Because I saw this boy, shackled from the waist to the floor. I have never, ever seen Omar Khadr not shackled from the waist to the floor. And handcuffed in a cell that was probably, I don't know, 6 feet wide, 10 feet long, no windows, no silence. And there was Omar Khadr. He doesn't sit in a chair like you do. Reasonably comfortable. He's never sat in a proper chair in all the time I've been with him. He's on a stool that bends, so he's always bending, which causes him problems because it's not a part of his body that's comfortable. And that's when we say to him, every part of his body twitched. He was just freezing. He was cold. His knees were causing him problems. He had problems with his face. His eyes got spots. And you think I'm a good lawyer. Well, you're wrong. Because I've been unable in all those years to obtain protective eyeglasses for Omar Khadr's one remaining poor but still able to see out of eye. And now as your government shows you how powerful we are with our good neighbours south of the border. Here's a young man who has one blind eye, another eye that's compensating for it, and we can't get him glasses to protect him from for us Lord. And when I met Omar Khadr, he wasn't talking either. He had withdrawn, and why not? He hadn't spoken for months. And so I talked at him for days. I talked about my wife. I talked about who I was. I just talked. I talked about my lake, my cabin by the lake. And I built it to be more than what it was. And I still wasn't getting anywhere. I remember, I'm not allowed to see his medical records. And not only am I not allowed to see his medical records, now he's the government. I challenge your government, challenge my government, to tell us that they have seen Omar Khadr's medical records. They haven't. And I have spent 6 years, probably less than that, I have files of pen pal relationships with government officials, sending letters. I have tried for years to get Omar Khadr psychiatrically assessed. And your government has, I can see this much of it, they've tried, so they tell me, but we haven't been able, until very recently, get them independently assessed. And it was in those conditions I persuaded this young man to come out of his mind and talk to me. And what happened was at one point I gave him a picture of my son Duncan, who plays hockey. Duncan was, I don't know, maybe 10 and a half at the time. I think he's 13 now. And it was then Omar took the photograph of Duncan that every parent has of their kid who plays hockey or soccer. There's Duncan there with his hockey gear on, the name of his team. And then we started talking. And we've continued to talk. And I cannot say to you that what I did was a meritorious thing. Because what did he wake up to? What did he come back to? What he came back to was reality. The reality of Guantanamo Bay. And he was, after that visit, that first visit, I asked him what he'd like me to bring him. And he wanted crayons, he wanted to draw. But that's against the rules. Omar's life stopped at 15 years of age. Many of you are parents here today. Many of you have watched your child develop from 15 to 22. I can tell you, I've got a boy who's 19. I can tell you about his development at this stage of life. He's been able to challenge me. He's been able to let me drive. He's been able to make choices. He's been able to do many things. Omar Khadr got nothing. No TV, no radio, no books, no education, nothing. So he very recently, because he's now in facing trial against the reed, got nothing. His life stopped. I can tell you I've represented all kinds of individuals. I've represented probably my first and only terrorist trial outside the borders of Canada. I represented an Irish terrorist who was convicted. I've represented Murphy. Omar Khadr. And they were all treated better than Omar Khadr. And so for the past 6 years then, when Tan was held Omar dead still in what I would describe as the vacuum of his cell, without ever allowing him to come to rest. Until recently. Omar, because we're now in the military commission process and we're now facing trial, Omar has been moved from Camp 6 into the cages. And you know what? He thinks all his Christmases and birthdays have come at once. That's the extent of privilege that he sees. He gets to be in solitary confinement in a cage. But it's better because he sees human beings walking. I've never seen anybody so abandoned and so abused, as I said to you earlier, than this young man. And what I can tell you about, I can tell you that I've never seen such a nice kid. And some of you may chuckle to yourselves. Well, I can tell you, I say this anywhere and everywhere. I say it amongst the most hardened audiences. He's a lovely young man. I've never heard him say one cruel word. I asked him if I got him home, what would he do? He said, I'd like to go and thank everybody who's been trying to help me. Imagine that. Imagine him having some compassion for human beings, when human beings have just treated him so terribly. I admire him so much. I admire the strength of those detainees who suffer so much. And I'm tired of the nonsense that I hear about a Taliban kid. He needs to be rehabilitated. He doesn't need that. What he needs peace and love. And a long journey to heal from man to humanity to him. So let me be very clear here as I move down. There is no due process in Guantanamo Bay. None whatsoever. To state otherwise is simply wrong. And a cynical attempt by our government to fool you, the Canadian public. The military commission process under which Omar is being tried is a sham and a fake. It has been condemned internationally by international bodies, human rights organizations, by jurors, and by US military personnel themselves. And it's so obviously unfair that countries such as Britain, France, Germany, and other European countries refuse to have their citizens and their nationals tried before that military commission process, and their nationals and their citizens were returned. So what does that say about the value of Canadian citizenship when other countries feel that Guantanamo is not good enough for an American, a Brit, a European, but it's good enough for a young Canadian Muslim? And I keep emphasizing Muslim, because we don't have time tonight to talk about racial profiling. But he's a young Canadian Muslim. Canada is simply the only Western country to give the United States carte blanche with one of its citizens at Guantanamo Bay. Britain, Australia, Sweden, Germany fought to repatriate all their nationals and adults, each and every one of them. Indeed, not only did they fight, but they were successful. Whereas Canada simply let a juvenile language who is entitled to special safeguards under international law. Now, I know our Prime Minister insists there's no other option for Omar, but to continue with the controversial US military tribunals. It's simply nonsense. The issue is not, as Mr. Harper implies, that the Canadian justice system lacks legal tools to deal with Mr. Khan. We have sufficient provisions in our criminal code to deal with the extraterritorial activity of a Canadian abroad who is allegedly commits terrorism offences. It is that by Canada's notions of fair process, the US case against Omar Khan would just simply unravel. And I could go on and I won't. So as I conclude this call, this talk, the question that persists throughout is, how did all this happen? How is it possible that so many military personnel of all stripes could be involved in such an obviously an abusive program for years without a single voice of protest being raised? Whatever happened to basic human decency. Where was and where is the moral courage and compassion that differentiate the human from the inhuman? And that inquiry, I say to you, ladies and gentlemen, does not just stop at the doorsteps of the United States, nor at the doorsteps of our own government, because we ourselves have to consider our own roles. Because if the life of Omar can be so easily devalued, then what does that say about each and every one of us here tonight? So I say to you, the greatest crime you can do is be silent. I started this talk off giving you a context. I said to you, why should we do something? Because if we don't, who will?
Yeah.
And it's part of your Muslim faith, a very essential part of your Muslim faith, to take care of your neighbour. And your neighbour is not just the Muslim guy next door. Your neighbour is mankind. And you as Muslim people from all over the world, with an ancient history, and history that one has to be proud of, and a culture that take care of, for example, that you rank amongst the most educated cultural group in Canada alone. You're involved in every facet of society. You have absolutely nothing to apologize for. Absolutely nothing. There has been people who have stood up and said silly things that purported to represent the Muslim voice. That's nonsense. If an Irish Catholic or a Scottish Protestant blew up a building in London, would the Catholic faith or the Protestant faith be condemned for it as terrorists? Not at all. By your own silence, you don't just let Omar Khadr down, or yourself down, you let every Muslim down. It's time that your voices were raised. You have nothing to be ashamed of, and you have everything to be proud of. You have, in fact, a living faith. We come from different religious backgrounds, but you know, you have a living faith. You're supposed to pray 5 times a day. You are the leaders who are not accepting the mantle. And by doing so, you're letting down your youth. So I thank you for allowing me to talk this evening. And thank you very much.
You have actually put us to shame. we call ourselves Muslims. One of our own is being tortured, humiliated, and we look the other way. I tell you, all of the prayers that you are offering,
it's good for nothing.
I say it from the bottom of my heart, are useless if you do not stand up for truth and justice. In the Quran, there is an ayat in which Allah orders the angels to go and destroy a community because they are bad people. And the angels turn to Allah and say, "Oh Allah, there are people over there who pray all the time." And Allah says to the angels, "Go and destroy them first." And the angels ask, "Oh Allah, why?" He said, "Because these people saw terrible things happening in that society. And these people simply concerned themselves only with their ritual prayers, and they did not stop that injustice from happening over there." You know, let me tell you, if you do not stand up for truth and justice, your turn will also come. Don't hide behind the thing that we have freedom in this country. I can tell you, 27 years ago, I was in the US addressing a gathering of students in Ann Arbor, and I talked to them about the way the American government is conducting its policies and how it is a threat to the freedom of people around the world. And one Muslim student got up after that talk that I gave and he said, "What do you know about American government? We are free in this country. We can say whatever we like. We can do whatever we like." I turned around and I said, "Yes, you can do it today. A day will come when that American government will consider you a threat and you will be put behind bars. And I have lived to see that day in the United States. And I can tell you, sitting over here, if you do not stand up for truth and justice, be prepared to end up in Guantanamo Bay. You have a choice. You want to live as free people, or you want to end up in Guantanamo Bay like Omar and so many other Muslims have done." Freedom is never given. It's never offered on a plate. You have to fight for it. That's as simple as that. It's not today. You go and read the Quran and you'll find out. People have to fight against oppression and tyranny. You don't just get it on a plate. You have to struggle for it. You have to raise your voices. Nobody is asking you to pick up guns or bombs or whatever. But if you cannot raise your voices, then be prepared to end up in the cages. So you have a choice. I think you heard what Dennis said. With great emotions. You know, lawyers are not emotional people. But you could hear the pain in his voice. Urging you, as Muslims, urging you that you have a responsibility. Then we can go home after this program and forget about it and say, "Well, we attended a program, we heard a nice speech, we had some good friends, good company, we ate and we go all went home." Or we can do something about it. And what that something is, twofold. Number one, I urge you all to pledge that you will continue to strive and struggle until we get justice and fairness for Omar Khayyam.